Meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. There is a quorum present. Just a few things to go through before we get to today's agenda, the things that we say every time before committee. Everyone here today must be seated when they're in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need accommodations, please let our staff know. Signs are not permitted in the room or at the testifiers' table and should be left outside. Clapping and other disruptions aren't allowed. And then all of the testifiers who have signed up in advance have been provided with a time limit. And we'll, when we call for public testimony, we'll also be timing you. And it's not to be rude, but it's just to make sure that we're hearing from everybody and have time to discuss the bills as a committee. We first, before we get started, need approval of the minutes from March 22nd, 2024. Representative Ingen, would you like to approve those minutes?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. All those in favor of approval of, for the minutes for March 22nd, 2024, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 22nd, 2024 are approved. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 3761. It's a Representative Finke bill. And I will move to lay over House File 3761. Welcome to the committee, Representative Finke, and your bill is before us, so please go ahead and tell us about it.
Thank you so much, Chair Mohler and committee members. For the record, my name is Lee Finke. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm here with House File 3761, the Safety Through Support Act. Members, there is clear established data showing that a successful reentry of our incarcerated neighbors is directly correlated to people coming to visit them while they're living in our prisons. It's not hard to imagine why this is true. We all need human connection. A study of visitation in Minnesota's prisons showed recidivism rates drop significantly simply by having visitors. The more visitors, the lower the recidivism rate. The closer familial ties of those visitors, the lower the recidivism rate. Unfortunately, up to 50% of incarcerated people will have zero visitors during their time living in our prisons. Among the reasons that people aren't able to visit is cost, restrictive visiting times, and the distance. It's not easy sometimes to visit your loved ones. We'll hear more about that in our testimony. I believe it is our moral responsibility to ensure that all people have human connection regardless of their situation. But the Safety Through Support Act is also good economic policy and good public safety policy. Lowering our recidivism rate will save the state money and it will keep our communities safer. So the Safety Through Support Act seeks to expand visitation to our incarcerated population. It adds mentoring as a cause for visitation, expands the definitions of who is able to visit to include mental health and medical professionals. And it would create a task force to support the rehabilitation and reentry of incarcerated persons, more specifically creating a system to ensure that everyone receives the benefits of visitation while they are incarcerated. That's the high-level walk through the bill. We can have more discussion later, but I will turn it over to my testifiers.
All right, thank you. The first person on the list is Holly Kathleen Bott, and then Zeke Caligiuri is up next, so if you wanted to come forward and be close to the testifiers table when we call on you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself when you're situated and you can begin your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning. I am Holly Bott and I am here to share my story and strongly advocate for the passage of this Safety Through Support Act. It is a critical measure to enhance safety in our society. 5 years ago, I was released from MCF Shakopee after having served a 12-year sentence. Let me tell you, that walk away wasn't just about leaving prison. It was about coming back to life. And it was my visits with family and friends that kept me going through those years. You see, my loved ones didn't just visit me. They made it a priority. They drove long miles, thousands of miles, sacrificed vacations, and committed to showing up regularly for my entire time there. Their commitment wasn't just about seeing me, it was about keeping me grounded, focused, and ready for the day I could step out again and rebuild my life. I finished my time as a model inmate, and today I am a successful business owner. The evidence is clear. Community connection is pivotal for reentry success, but here's the thing. Not everyone has that kind of support, and that's where this bill comes in. It's not just about visits. It's about building connections that make a real difference. Take my husband, for example. I met him after my release in 2019 when I committed to visiting those that I had left behind and never saw have a visit. That was 5 years ago, and next month will be our first wedding anniversary. When we connected in 2019, his life in prison took a very positive turn. His first decade in prison was marked by serious discipline issues, violence, and addiction. No programming at all. His choice. Since our meeting and regular visits, he successfully completed many programs, earned a college degree, and remains free, discipline free, and has been for years. Yet the system has its limits. If I choose to be a volunteer inside prison, I can't be on any inmates visiting list. And if I opt to visit inmates instead, I'm restricted to visiting just two different people. This constraint severely limits the impact I can make and the connections I can continue to foster. This bill is a chance to change that, remove unnecessary barriers, and enable meaningful interactions that can truly make a difference. I want to just add one thing. Talking about mental health, I entered prison with clinical depression. I even spent time on suicide watch. My access to counseling and mental health care in prison was extremely limited despite my previously diagnosed illness, and my husband has encountered even more limited access, even denial of mental health care. Access to this support is crucial, and it saves lives. This bill sets up a task force to ensure everyone gets the help they need, breaking down barriers and giving people a real shot at good mental health. So I urge you to pass this bill. It's not just about me or my husband. It's about everyone out there who deserves a second chance and a path to a better future. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony, and congratulations on your successes and to your husband as well. And thank you for advocating for others. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, next up we have Zeke Caligiuri. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mahler, members of the committee. My name is Zeke Caligiuri. I'm from the Reenfranchise Coalition, working to empower newly reenfranchised voters, and as well as those still incarcerated in our state system. I come to you here as somebody who has experienced what a cell feels like, right? I was so fortunate to have a family and friends who showed up and supported me throughout my time. Part of what made this possible was because they were able to visit consistently during designated visiting times. Consistency made all that possible. I was also fortunate enough to be embraced by my community during a period of time of my incarceration that offered me opportunities to learn skills that I would be able to bring out with me after my incarceration. I come because if we want human beings to act and think as human beings within these spaces, we have to respect and facilitate that person's humanity, and to the humanity of the people who love them and are willing to take their often over-leveraged time to spend it with their incarcerated loved ones. I went through the pandemic inside of a cell and watch how something as vital to reentry success as visiting just disappeared due to the measures needed during that time, only to return sporadically and to take a backseat to other things like staffing in those facilities. We have all the numbers that will tell you all the things about the validity of visiting and people's need to stay connected outside. At some point in our state's history, we decided that the family system and that the supporters and friends of incarcerated people were somehow criminal and not do the same sort of respect and humanity that they should have. Little has been done in the last 30 years to address physical and psychological conditions within our state's facilities. There's drastic need to address the use of discipline and punishment within those facilities, as well as the deteriorating infrastructures that make living in those places more challenging. Visiting is the clearest, most direct way to improve the DOC's interactions with the loved ones of incarcerated people. It's where they're able to show decency and respect for the time that these free world visitors, the time of these free world visitors, instead of reinforcing the humiliating and degrading disregard for humanity of those being visited and those visiting. There's a very matriarchal core to the people who are coming to visit these places. I remember my mother, who came and visited me twice a week for 20 years, speaking to me about coming in and the metal detectors being set so high that the women would have to go to the bathroom, cut out the wire from their bras just so that they could come in and visit their loved ones. I had my own 90-year-old grandmother turned away because they told her sundress on a 95-degree day was too provocative. Truth be told, these people didn't commit a crime or anything to deserve the sort of treatment that it took just to walk them through these doors. Right? This tells me that it's important to recognize the value of the family and the community to restore the people who live in these places. Right? We've heard often the idea of restored people, restoring communities. Well, the truth be told is, if you create a safer, more comfortable environment for those who live in those places, they will treat the staff better in those places. They will treat the people in their lives better. We are building stronger, healthier human beings. And I believe that this particular bill helps to do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony, and also congratulations to you on your successes, and appreciate your advocacy as well. Do we have
Thank
any
you, Chairman.
Members of the public who wish to testify? All right. Hi. Come on forward. Welcome back to the committee, and if you want to just introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Moeller. Members, my name is Elliot Butai. I'm the Senior Policy Coordinator at NAMI Minnesota, and I just want to speak in support of 100% support of everything everyone's already said, and also just to give the perspective, we get lots of calls now, more calls that they're free to NAMI. We've gotten letters for years of people needing mental health support in prisons, and you know, mental health, mental illnesses are different sometimes than physical illnesses in that there's not necessarily like 5 therapy sessions you can go to and your mental health is better. And I just want to really emphasize how important these visits are for people. And as somebody who lives with PTSD and a mental illness, you're not sure when that point of connection is going to kind of move you forward in your journey. And sometimes you have 3 connections with a family member that you're trying to work something out with, and they don't feel great, and the 4th one is when you make a breakthrough. And so as we literally don't have the money, don't have the mental health professionals to work in our prisons, I would like to frame this as a kind of medicine, that people need this to keep moving forward, and everything that's been said is true. They come out better, our communities are better while they're inside, so really important and fully supported. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Anybody else from the public wishing to testify? All right. I'm not seeing anybody else, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. I have no interest in arguing for the status quo. Surely there are opportunities for us to provide greater access, especially to what the last testifier spoke to, mental health services, and access to mentors, people who are going to help with the process of rehabilitation. My concern with the way that this bill is drafted falls into 2 categories. One is what I see as a pretty obvious exposure to discrimination, which I'll unpack here in a moment, and the other is a security concern. Maybe I'll just start there because that's the one that's easiest to articulate. So in lines 231 and 232, we're going to say that the commissioner may not use strip searches for incarcerated persons before or following a meeting with a visitor unless there is a credible, documented security concern. And I'm not sure, and perhaps you can provide an example of what that would look like in terms of a credible, documented security concern. It occurs to me that the credible, documented security concern is that they're a convicted criminal who has been incarcerated, and what that means is that certain civil rights have been curtailed. That's what incarceration is. And that status onto itself presents a credible, documented security concern. There's a need to control contraband moving in to and circulating around our correctional facilities. And I guess I'll start there with, could you unpack what the thought process is there, and do you share any security concerns with that language?
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, Representative Hudson. We have many experts in the room who can talk to the drafting of why the language is what the language is. But I would say specifically, I do not share the idea that a conviction means that you are forever a security concern. I do believe that the notion that your conviction is always a predetermined factor of your being a security risk, I simply reject that. That's not a humane way to understand the people who are in our prisons. But if somebody wants to come up and talk about the specific language and why we decided to change the strip search language, I would welcome that.
Looks like Ms. Bott is returning to the table, so thank you for being available to answer that question. Go ahead.
So during my incarceration, there were no body scanners in the prison, which there are today for visits. And many of the women I was incarcerated with were victims of previous abuse and rape, sexual assault, and so they didn't want visits. I remember one specific incident. They were training new guards, and I had had so many visits that by this time, the strip search and everything that you do behind the ears, open your mouth, wave your hands, I knew it by heart. And a guard came in and said, "Don't do any of that. We're training a new guard. She's going to come in. She's going to tell you what to do. Wait for her instructions." And this guard came in, and the guard looked traumatized. And she could not remember anything to tell me. So I stood there frozen and naked, waiting to be told what to do, while two guards stared at me. One of them just slack jaw with, "This is so traumatizing for her. She can't give me instructions." And finally, and I was nervous because to disobey a direct order means seg, or discipline, or my visits restricted. But finally, I couldn't take the tension anymore, and I just proceeded without her telling me anything. And they both looked at the, you know, ashamed, and it was just awful. I have had thousands of strip searches. And now that the body scanners are available, women who didn't want visits before are now asking their families to come in. And they just, you know, they get a pat search, they're quickly scanned, and they're on their way, and the strip search doesn't happen. So I can speak to the psychological trauma of those things.
Great, thank you. And I just want to make sure that we keep things moving, and just so people in the public know and the committee knows, I intend to have, we're laying this bill over today. I intend in the interim to have a very long discussion about all things DOC related. I would love to have like a half day session for us to really delve into a lot of these issues. They're very important. And so I know we're gonna feel rushed today a little bit, but I just want to let committee members know that that's something that I would really like to do as a committee to discuss later. Any follow-up, Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, and I'll try to make it as concise as possible. So certainly if the function that a strip search serves can be served in another way that's more dignified, by all means. This language doesn't make it clear that that's the intention. My other concern that I'll raise is just regarding the potential discrimination that this bill could empower. I mean, we're going to create a diversity task force that is going to determine a number of people who get to be in a special class of enabled visitors who have all this additional access to incarcerated people, to inmates, and not to the rest of us. And the reason why that's problematic is currently, right now, there's an ongoing lawsuit involving the Department of Corrections where an official abruptly canceled a Christian rehabilitation program at the correctional facility in St. Cloud. It's described as an instrumental tool that was facilitating successful transitions to the community for male prison inmates over the past decade, which is the express purpose that we seem to be going after. And yet, currently right now, there's reason to believe that there's ongoing discrimination against certain points of view and certain religious perspectives, most certainly. And so the idea that we're going to have these gatekeepers who are going to be determining who gets to have access to incarcerated people and who has to go by the old, more restrictive rules is something that I find deeply concerning. Thank you.
Did you want to address that, Representative Finke?
Thank you, Chair Mueller and Representative Hudson. I would say that the purpose of this task force is to ensure that everyone has visitors who can meaningfully contribute to their lives. And discriminatory practices by the Department of Corrections are certainly not my purview.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Finke, for bringing this forward. I think when I look at this language, I think you're right. There's like a couple of places that we could probably tighten it up or make more specific the things that we're doing. But in general, I really support this. And I just wanted to express my support for this because having worked as a lawyer and interacting with a number of people who are incarcerated, the reality is without those ties to the outside community, people lose hope and they lose perspective. And it really inhibits their ability to grow and become better people and functioning members of society. And I think that's our goal in general, is to make sure that folks go through this process, serve time, and then come out as members of a participatory member of our society. And when you lose connection to the outside world, there's no reason to do better. There's no reason to work harder. There's no reason to try to rectify the things that you have done or, establish, a different mindset. And so I really do believe that having those connections, especially positive connections to the outside community, is really, really important. And so I want to thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I see we have Commissioner Schnell in the audience. Can I ask him a quick question if possible?
Well, he's going to be talking about his bill in a little bit too. So just in the sake of keeping things moving, you're going to have questions for him as well. Well, why don't we'll allow those when we're talking about, unless it's like very specific about the language. Are you, is the question about the language or more of a process? For
more of a process, so I can wait.
Let's wait and do that. Okay. Is that okay? Representative Novotny will do that for you as well. Okay. Anything then at this point, Representative Witte? No? All right. Chair Becker Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just wanted to thank Representative Finke for bringing this forward. It's always struck me, serving on these committees, it's the Department of Corrections. It's not the Department of Punishment. It's the idea is that, and the reality is that most of these people are going to return to our communities, and the better connected they are to their loved ones and their communities and the resources, the better off we're all going to be when they're released, because the reality is we can't just keep everybody locked up indefinitely. I also wanted to note that many incarcerated people are not in for violent crimes. So I just want to make sure we're being careful as we talk about incarcerated folks, that we're not necessarily lumping them all in the same category. And to what Representative Finke said, we don't necessarily know that just because somebody's convicted of something that it means that they're necessarily always going to be a violent or dangerous person in any way. I was just double checking. I know we don't currently charge a fee for visitors, but I think it is important to update our language to reflect that isn't something we should be doing. And finally, I would just say on the task force, maybe it's a task force on support rehabilitation and reentry. Maybe we don't have to call it a diversity task force. It could just be a task force where we are openly making sure we have people from all kinds of different backgrounds. And that includes folks in marginalized communities and others. It includes everybody. And so that would be my suggestion as we move forward, and I think a way to make sure this is workable and fair to everybody involved. But I just really appreciate this because, again, we know recidivism rates go down when people have connections to their community. It's a huge indicator of success. So thank you for bringing this forward, and I'm glad we're considering it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you want to respond, Representative Finke?
Thank you, Chair Mueller. I just wanted to thank Chair Becker Finn, but I did also want to point out that one of the key pieces of diversity that we are trying to resolve in this task force is geographic, right? We are, so I know that that word itself, I have no problem with changing the language to make it clear, but one of the biggest problems is geographic diversity and how we move people and bodies from where they are to where their loved ones are incarcerated.
Thank you. Representative Buehler.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Finke. Like Walter Hudson, I have no interest in keeping the status quo, but I'm a data person, and so I just had a couple of questions. The first is, and maybe this is for you, Chair Mueller, of if there was a fiscal note that had been requested, or if we had any type of fiscal note response to this.
I believe one has been requested, and we're maybe John Walls wants to address it.
Madam Chair, Representative Mueller, fiscal note has been requested, but it has not been signed off by the LBO at this time.
And that's one reason why we're laying it over. Yeah, go ahead, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. And then the other question, I was really interested. You said that you were looking at a study on visitation and had cited several statistics from there. I was wondering if you could provide that study. I love reading studies so that I can kind of understand some of the context of where some of these bills are written up.
Representative Finke.
Yes, thank you, Chair Mueller. And I agree, Representative Mueller, and the Department of Corrections can send you that link. I can send you that link, but I also asked for follow-up and more recent information, and there's a whole wealth of information that we have that makes it so clear that visitation makes our community safer and will save us money. So I'm happy to make sure you, I mean, this bill is responding almost directly to everything that 2011 study said we need to do to make sure our communities are safer.
And Representative Finke, I would just say if it's you or the department, whoever's sharing a study, if you could share that with our committee administrators so we can make sure all of us get a copy of that. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Finke. And that's actually really interesting that because that was one of my questions as I was going to read the study is, does it take into the effect of the pandemic? One of your testifiers talked about the devastating effect on IPs from the pandemic and how isolation was crushing. And I couldn't agree more. I was teaching during that time, and I didn't know if there was any study that had included in pandemic showed visitation rates before and after and what that included. And maybe that research doesn't exist yet, but I just wanted to be able to kind of see where that was coming from. Thank you, Chair Mueller.
Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and for the question. The data that I looked at may not be as specific as that question, but there is data that shows at least about the use of remote technology to visit. The costs of that can be prohibitive, but the value of that has been studied and shown that it is also very important to lowering recidivism rates.
All right, any further member questions? Not seeing any, so closing remarks, Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and the committee members for the discussion. I think that this bill, we have to do some updates on our language, and I'm happy to work with anybody on doing that. But as our final testifier said, this is medicine. I love that. This is what medicine looks like in our mental health communities. This is what medicine looks like when we're serving our incarcerated neighbors. I say incarcerated neighbors because 95% of the people who are in prison will be out of prison. And it is our duty to do everything we can while they are in our care to make sure they succeed when they are going into reentry. So thank you so much.
Thank you again, Representative Finke, and the testifiers. We appreciate you being here today, especially on this snowy day. So glad you made it in safely. And with that, I renew the motion and lay over House File 3761. The next bill is Representative Pinto's bill, House File 4959. And I believe the motion, Representative or Chair Pinto, is to re-refer House File 4959 to the Committee on State and Local Government Finance and Policy. Is that your motion?
It is my motion, Madam Chair. It doesn't make much sense with the current version of the bill, but it will after we amend the bill.
Okay, so you have the A1 amendment. Would you like to move and explain the A1 amendment, please?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So members, the underlying bill establishes a task force on holistic and effective responses to illicit drug use. We'll talk more about that in a minute. But the thinking is that task force is more properly housed within the Office of Addiction and Recovery. I believe I have the name correctly. And so wanted to direct the funding and the oversight there, and then also the amendment adds specific duties to the task force. Is something that was going to be catching up to the draft of the bill, and we've now had a chance to do that in the A1.
All right, great. And I see that there's an A2 amendment to the A1, and I believe, Lead Novotny, you're offering the A2?
Yes, ma'am.
So you've moved the A2. Would you like to explain to us what it does?
excuse me. The A1 amendment changes the line 7 from the deleting Commissioner of Public Safety and inserts the Office of Addiction and Recovery. And speaking with Representative Pinto yesterday, staff was able to catch that there's another part in the bill where it was not changed, page 2, line 22. So we just want to, A2 would just amend A1 so that all of the phrasing lines up, that the Office of Addiction and Recovering can be in the first meeting of the task force. And I did speak with Representative Pinto about this yesterday, just to clean up.
Okay, great. Chair Pinto to the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the catch, and yeah, I do consider this a friendly amendment. Would urge members' support of the A2.
All right, so Lead Novotny moves the A2 amendment to the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A2 amendment is adopted. And now the underlying amendment, the A1 amendment as amended. Any discussion to that? All those in favor of the A1 amendment as amended signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A1 amendment as amended is adopted. Now, Representative Pinto, your bill as amended is before us, so please tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members. So House File 4959, as I mentioned, establishes a task force on holistic and effective responses to illicit drug use. And this is really a follow-up to the report that we initiated and funded last session regarding a similar topic. This task force would bring together a group of diverse stakeholders to accept public input and to make recommendations following on the report that we recently received, the preliminary version of which there'll be a final version coming out next year on illicit drug use. Just to remind folks, the thinking is that there are a lot of problems with currently how we deal with the issue of illicit drugs in our society. And we know that we spend a lot on criminalizing. We know that we have a huge amount of continued impact, despite that, continued negative impact on people's lives. People continue to be addicted, continue to have really negative behaviors, continue to have all sorts of problems. And so I had initiated the report last year to say, okay, what are best practices around the world for dealing with this, with no particular assumption about where things head, but simply to say, what is the best way to ensure a society that is as safe and as healthy as possible when it comes to illicit drugs being out there. So we received a preliminary report a couple weeks ago. We'll receive a final report next year. And in the meantime, it seemed that be helpful for us to have this task force be established to continue the work. And I do have a couple testifiers who can provide more information, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. The first person on the list is Dr. Ryan Kelly. So please come on forward. And then Chaz Anderson, if you want to make your way down towards the table too, we'd appreciate it.
Hello.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Hi, good morning. My name is Ryan Kelly. I am an internal medicine, pediatric, and addiction medicine physician at the University of Minnesota. I am the director of addiction consults at the University of Minnesota Medical Center. I also practice primary care and addiction medicine at the Community University Healthcare Center in FQHC in Minneapolis. I'm on the board with Southside Harm Reduction, which is a mobile search service program also in Minneapolis. And then finally, I'm chair of the Minnesota Medical Association's Subcommittee on Harm Reduction. So every day I'm working to improve access to care for my patients, many of whom don't have resources, for example, struggle with access to telephones, transportation, housing, to name a few. For my patients with substance use disorders, which are medical conditions, many of these patients have been criminalized by the justice system for these very same medical conditions. This leads to even decreased access of, obtaining resources, for example, trying to get work, housing, et cetera. This not only negatively impacts them, but also their families and their communities. The fentanyl crisis has made these challenges even worse. The illicit drug supply now is less predictable and much more potent. Not only that, fentanyl itself has interactions with the life-saving medication Suboxone, making it much more difficult for people to start it. What that means, so every day I'm struggling to help my patients, even the most motivated patients with opioid dependence, because number one, they can't access methadone. Number two, they're scared of Suboxone because of these interactions with fentanyl. You know, for people in rural Minnesota, people struggling with methamphetamine use, opioids, or both, there's lack of mobile services to help people. That means people have to travel well over 100 miles to obtain resources to feel better, do better, and to improve their health. Basically, in summary, new approaches are dramatically needed to improve the health of my patients and also patients across Minnesota that struggle with substance use. So that's why the Minnesota Medical Association, Southside Harm Reduction, myself, really support this task force. It's going to, dramatically address and implement changes that are needed to impact the lives of my patients. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Chaz Anderson and Anna Bosch is on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chaz Anderson, and I'm here on behalf of the Drug Policy Alliance and the Justice Action Network in support of House File 4959. This legislation is really born out of many meetings and discussions throughout the past year with individuals and organizations looking for better and more effective solutions for addressing the crisis that's happening with illicit drug use in Minnesota. We know that solutions must be comprehensive in nature and involve a wide range of stakeholders, including those from Health and Human Services, public safety, government, communities, and individuals with lived experiences. House File 4959 requires that the task force take input and engage with communities and the public, which we think is very important. Lastly, as noted in the legislation, the task force really specifically decided, or the legislation really utilizes the RISE research reports noted by Representative Pinto, and that work, as you know, was authorized and funded last session. And the task force will also work with other organizations and individuals in putting together recommendations for the legislature to continue next session and beyond. So with that, thank you for your consideration of House File 4959.
Thank you. Then we've got Anna Bosch. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Chair Mueller and members of the committee, my name is Anna Bosch. I'm the Harm Reduction Manager at Native American Community Clinic, or NAC. NAC is a FQHC that aims to address health disparities within the urban Native American community. We offer culturally centered health care and harm reduction services, including naloxone distribution, HIV and hepatitis C testing and treatments, and treatment for substance use disorders. We see the benefits of a harm reduction approach in that consistently folks that touch with our harm reduction staff are showing up at our clinic to receive support for their substance use when they are ready. Some even show up to volunteer weekly at our clinic. We are every day meeting people where they're at in mind, body, and spirit. When punishment, not health care or harm reduction, is a primary tool used to address drug use in Minnesota, our patients are more likely to use in isolation and experience overdose. A criminal record impacts our patient's ability to acquire and maintain housing, directly impacting their health outcomes. When our patients fear arrest, they are less likely to transparently seek out the evidence-based care that they deserve. Criminalization of substance use is a driving reason that our society often looks at people who use drugs with disdain, resulting in judgmental and traumatic care experiences and more care avoidance. We see the results of criminalization and its uneven application in the following. Native American Minnesotans are dying from overdose at over 9 times the rate as white Minnesotans. Native Americans in Minnesota are disproportionately experiencing homelessness and make up over 1/3 of the impacted individuals in an ongoing HIV outbreak amongst people who inject drugs and people experiencing homelessness. It is time for a better approach to substance use in Minnesota, one that centers harm reduction and public health. We support HF 4959 to establish a task force to consider research recommendations that center harm reduction and public health, as we see the tremendous benefits of these approaches and the work that we are honored to do every day at NAC. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Thanks for your testimony. Is there anybody from the public who wishes to testify on this bill? All right. I'm not seeing anybody, so we can move on to member discussion. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Pinto. I was going to ask you if you had read the report, but it sounds like you had read the report. And the reason why I was asking that is because normally these are supplied to us as legislators that are part of the committee so that we can read the report. I look back, I get millions of them just like everyone else, and I looked back at my email. I save everything under research. I did not find it. Went to RISE Research website. Did not find it. Finally, I think we dug it up. And it's 108 pages long. Pretty extensive. Just wondering when we were supposed to see it.
Well, and I'll just say I thought I received a copy of it, and usually those things are sent to everybody, so we'll make sure we get that out to everybody, and we can post it on our website as well. Everybody should get a copy of that. I wish we would have known before the hearing. We would have been glad to make sure that comes out, but
I just assumed, I'm sorry, Chair Mueller, I just assumed that I missed an email, honestly, and so that's why I went and dug through everything, and, you know, it was, because, I mean, a lot of the things, like all the testifiers said, this follows exactly the recommendations from the RISE research. Well, if we can't look at that, then I can't understand what some of the recommendations are. So I started reading it last night. I think I got to page 20 before I was able to fall back to sleep. But I am concerned that we weren't able to see this ahead of time.
Well, we'll be making sure everybody gets a copy of that. Chair Pinto, did you want to address that?
Yeah, I'll just note. Thank you, Madam Chair. It looks like it was sent to chairs and leads when it was at the time that it was due. I'll be honest, Representative Mueller, it's been a while since I've looked at it, but it was sent at that point. Yeah, So at the time, which so would be February 15th, I believe, and then I think was posted as well. But in any case, yeah, thank you for raising that. We can certainly make sure to get copies to folks as well. Thanks.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Representative Pinto. This is really important work, and I'm excited to see it. My one thought on this, based on my experience with people who have suffered from substance abuse disorders, and disproportionately the people I know who have suffered from them did not overdose, but in fact took their own lives. And I'm wondering if there's any space in this task force for what are they called? I'm going to get this wrong. Somebody who specializes in suicide. I should have looked this up first. I'm sorry. But there's a specific study of work that people do that looks at suicide and self-harm. And I'm wondering if there's any room for somebody who would specialize in that on this task force.
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hollins, for raising that. I think that's a really good observation and is worth examining. I will say one thing, as somebody who's set up and even this session is pushing through a number of task forces on my own committee as well, right? There is such a balance, right? That sort of each piece you add, and we want to make sure the task force is small enough that can work effectively, and we want to make sure that it's addressing every issue that it needs to. So I guess there's a question of sort of, do you have the expertise serve on the task force versus perhaps direct the task force to be sure to include that topic, the really important topic as part of it. But you raise a good point, and something that we'll keep an eye on as it moves forward. Thanks.
All right. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto, feel free to defer to your testifiers on this one. It's more of just trying to understand the thought process here, because it seems as though the consistent theme and what we're expecting to get back from this task force is something that affirms the idea that we need to decriminalize illicit drug use and drug possession. And that's an idea that I'm actually quite sympathetic with, but it reminds me of when we had a conversation last year about paraphernalia and our law enforcement members who've had experience in this area pointed out that often it's the encounter with law enforcement that triggers the individual to get connected with the services that they need in order to start recovery. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are, or what some of your testifiers' thoughts might be about if we're going to turn down the knob, so to speak, on criminalization, is there something that looks sort of like a civil commitment that can deal with the fact that often folks are not voluntarily engaging with recovery services that they need, not just for their own sake, but to ensure that they don't fall into more serious criminal activity, as we've seen in Oregon after they decriminalized?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the thoughtful question. It feels like that maybe I will be interested to get input from testifiers about your question. I should note it feels like it maybe gets a little bit ahead of things. To remind folks about where we are, we said last year there are problems with the war on drugs. We know that, if only because we're continuing to have massive drug use that's harming people's lives despite everything we're doing in that. And so we commissioned the report, and what came back, and Representative Mueller, sounds like we need to get this more spread. What came back were a series of policies that were identified in the preliminary report as being more beneficial in terms of safety and health, and that probably do send somewhat in the direction of some form of decriminalization. Need to get more details on that. I guess I view the task force then as saying, like, okay, but and what does that look like? And we're going to get a final report as well. So it feels a little speculative, but perhaps somebody's able to help provide, who's more an expert than me, as to what things might look like to deal with the problem that you've identified.
And I'll note that Chaz Anderson's returning to the testifiers table, and also just looking at the membership of the task force, that law enforcement is very much included in this discussion, mm-hmm. In this work too, which is important for them to have a seat at the table. Welcome back, Chaz Anderson, please, if you can answer that question.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. To answer that question, it's really the work of the task force, and that's why we set up a diverse group of stakeholders in the legislation so that they could take the report, make considerations, make recommendations, and the report that's issued that was discussed here is an initial report. There will be a final report, as noted by Representative Pinto, and that will be out early next year. But really, that's the work of the task force, Representative Hudson and members of the committee, is to consider the report, take the work, do additional research, take public input, and then make those recommendations.
Right, Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Representative Pinto, got a couple questions and then I'll close with a comment. My first question is, we don't have anybody on the task force representing the courts, especially the drug courts, that I can see. Somebody from the drug courts that's been active in this and has seen what works and what doesn't work, I think would be a valuable member, so we're not reinventing the wheel. Any comments on that? Or
yep. Chair Pinto,
thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, we'd need to ask, of course. We can't direct somebody from the courts. We can certainly ask them. That's a really intriguing point, Representative Novotny. I don't know about drug court in particular, potentially, but maybe more broadly, judicial system. We can see how very quickly you start getting a bigger and bigger task force, but having that branch of government be represented may well make sense.
Lead Novotny.
Thank you for looking at that. And just a final comment. You call it a war on drugs. I would currently describe it as a limited conflict intervention, that we keep de-escalating and it doesn't work, and our overdoses are going up, and at some point we're going to have to look at changing something. That won't be this session. Thank you.
Any closing remarks, Chair Pinto?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and thank you, Representative Novotny. I mean, I'll say, you know, the predominant model of addressing illicit drug use in our country for a long time has been a, you know, heavy-duty criminalization model. I think we have backed off from that in some respects, yet it still is the predominant mode, and we know that there are a lot of harms that are ongoing, and so I'm really excited about trying to move forward in a way that reflects the science, and I should say the report, we asked for that, and certainly with this as well. Where does the science lead us to have as safe and healthy a populace as possible? That's the goal, and we want to look at everything that does that. So thank you, Chair.
So Representative Pinto renews the motion to re-refer House File 4959 as amended to the Committee on State and Local Government, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Thank you also to those testifiers for coming in today. And then next we have a Department of Public Safety budget and bonding presentation. So we'll hear first from Commissioner Jacobson. And if all the planned testifiers for DPS want to kind of make your way forward, that would be helpful. And the presentation is also in the member packet and posted online. Welcome back to the committee. Commissioner, if you can introduce yourself and again and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jacobson, and I have the honor and privilege of serving as the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. With me today includes State Fire Marshal Dan Cryer, Executive Director Kate Weeks from the Office of Justice Programs, and Superintendent Drew Evans of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Today, we just wanted to provide you a quick update on some of the items that passed last year, an overview of the governor's supplemental budget, and our critical bonding needs. We want to thank this committee for the strong support and critical investments made last year in public safety. As you can see, our basic mission, serving all communities to build a safer Minnesota. I'd like to find a better picture of me one of these days, but thank you. The One Minnesota budget. The Walsh Flanagan administration is working together across agencies to make Minnesota the best state for kids and families. That's why Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's 2023 One Minnesota budget invested in public safety initiatives that will serve all communities to build a safer Minnesota. This includes funding to reduce violent crime, combat human trafficking, invest in prevention and intervention activities, fund victim services, support 911 call centers, firefighter training, and much more. It also includes the largest investment in public safety ever, with $300 million sent to cities, counties, and tribal nations, giving them the ability to invest in their public safety needs. Some of the implementation updates. Last year's public safety budget included many great investments into DPS to make Minnesota safer. Again, increased funding is available to local fire departments to provide training for local firefighters, expanded the line of duty death benefit to cover suicide linked to PTSD, increased funding for nonprofit security grants. We created the nation's first missing and murdered black women and girls office. We're also still working to create the Office of Restorative Practices. We're working also, other implementation updates can include last year's bill that increased our funding for victims of crime, youth intervention programs, and community crime prevention and prevention. We also created funding for the Intensive Comprehensive Peace Officer Education and Training Program. Thank you for that. That will help hopefully to get 100 more peace officers in the state of Minnesota. And then thanks to last year's funding, the BCA's violent crime team is now officially in place, and that will allow us to continue and expand our work to reduce violent crime. With that funding provided, we get to reduce evidence turnaround time, and we've already seen an improvement, and we are on track to hit our 90-day mark. This is a very high-level overview of those items passed last year, but we wanted to remind the committee of all that great work that has been done. And with that, I will pass it off to State Fire Marshal Dan Cryer to start on the supplemental budget request.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your portion of the testimony.
Good morning, Chair Moeller and committee members. Thank you for having me. I'm Daniel Cryer. I'm the State Fire Marshal. I was appointed to this position last September, so entering month seven in this role. It's very excited to be here, so maybe someone should tell that guy in the photo that he can smile a little bit. Well, thank you. As part of the supplemental budget, the governor's and our request is looking to have all of our state emergency response teams included as eligible expenses in the non-responsible party fund. The members of these teams are members from local fire departments, state patrol, and then they have contracts or formal agreements through the Department of Public Safety, specifically with the State Fire Marshal Division. The two teams that we're looking to add into this are Urban Search and Rescue, also known as USAR, or Task Force 1 and Task Force 2, as well as Minnesota Air Rescue Teams, or MART. These funds into this account for the non-responsible party fund, they're funded through the fire safety account appropriation, and they are for funds where a responsible party cannot be identified and therefore billed and charged. Additionally, we're looking to have a recommendation to have the definition of urban search and rescue meet a nationally recognized language and not have something that's just specific to Minnesota. So with that, we'll have our Executive Director of Office of Justice Programs.
All right. Welcome back, Director Weeks. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs within the Department of Public Safety. The first provision, the governor recommends an additional $10 million to help support the critical services provided by crime victim services across Minnesota. Crime victim service funding covers advocacy and direct service for sexual assault, domestic abuse, child abuse, and other crimes such as homicide, gun violence, assault, and theft. Crime victim services are a critical need in every community and are available to support survivors through crisis intervention, advocacy, applying for protective orders, safe housing, transportation, accessing financial assistance, court-related support, accompaniment to hearings and appointments, support groups, responding with law enforcement to critical incidences, and healing services for as long as an individual or family is in need. OJP has heard from multiple organizations that additional funding is needed for services throughout Minnesota. The second provision is the Youth Intervention Grant Program has a grant administration amount set in statute at 2%. In order to ensure that all of the Office of Grant Administration and OLA requirements and guidance are being met, the governor proposes to raise this to match the new state standard for competitive grants established last session to allow state agencies up to 10%. This proposal ensures a successful transfer of the YIP grant program over to the new Department of Children, Youth, and Families on July 1st, 2025 by ensuring that the program and administration will be properly funded. Thank you, and I will now pass it over to Superintendent Evans.
All right, thank you. Welcome back, Superintendent Evans. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I've been asked to speak briefly to you about a bonding request for additional space critically needed for the BCA moving forward. In the governor's bonding request, there is two pieces that are related to the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension space. The first is to complete construction for a new BCA laboratory and investigative regional office in Mankato, Minnesota. We've purchased the land for this facility, which was provided by the legislature last year, funding for that request, and we are in the process of entering into design services. So this is generally as shovel-ready a project as needed. If I was here talking about some of our law enforcement operations, I wouldn't be here speaking about this space specifically. It is designed for our laboratory needs in particular. For example, you provided funding for a new violent crime reduction team that is up and operating now. That team's going to go into an old fire station that we're in the process of remodeling a couple miles north of our headquarters in Maplewood, Minnesota. But I will explain to you specifically why this is needed for our laboratory. And then the second piece is we operate a laboratory and a regional office in Bemidji, Minnesota. We have needs for additional space in that location as well, and it would provide funding to acquire land and design purchases to expand that facility. One of the things that we've been looking at that's driven this need is crime trends continue to evolve and grow in terms of the actual needs of our laboratory testing facilities that we have. Digital evidence, for example, when I first started at the BCA, there was one agent that did digital evidence examination part-time. We have 22 full-time examiners right now doing just digital evidence alone, and our facilities were never designed to house those types of laboratories. We continue to see significant increases in the number of narcotics that come into our facilities, as well as DNA in particular. DNA is one of those examinations for forensic analysis that continues to grow over time as we learn how it can be used and is often thought of as the gold standard in forensic science. One of the things in your slide deck that you can see, our evidence submission for DNA analysis has increased by 200% in the last decade. One of the areas that we've been thinking critically through with all of you is in those areas that we have challenges with staffing law enforcement, forensic science is one of those areas that we can bridge the gap by testing evidence more quickly with an acceptable time frame so that we can get answers and lessen the number of traditional investigative hours that we need for solving crimes. Digital media just between 2017 and 2021 has increased by 122% in our labs. These are examples as to why I'm talking to you about laboratory space. I know it's small on the screen here, but it's an example of the specialized type of space that we need for a laboratory. Our laboratories have specialized HVAC systems. For example, the air in our facilities gets turned over once every hour because of the chemicals and different solvents that are in the testing process. We need specific spacing to keep the instrumentation cool. On the left-hand side, as you look at it, that's a gas chromatograph mass spectrometer. It's a drug laboratory, specialized equipment that's needed. The picture that you see on the right hand is our CODIS room, and the CODIS is the combined DNA index system that has very highly specialized security needs for that and accessing those systems. They can't even access those at their desktops, even though we have a lot of security in place because it's an offline system designed to access the nationwide DNA system, and we simply may need more space. What this would also do is provide a couple of different things to ensure that we create efficiencies by relocating a laboratory. One might ask, why don't you just add on to your headquarters location where the bulk of our forensic science testing is being done currently? By relocating staff into a different facility in southern Minnesota, we gain efficiency simply by relocating them. Our scientists, you think of as doing analysis and DNA, whatever it might be, but they spend a lot of time on the road testifying in the 87 different courthouses across Minnesota. By relocating the same staff to a different part of the state, they, instead of spending the whole day traveling, testifying, traveling back, they can go travel, testify, come back, and have additional hours to do analysis by being more closely aligned with those areas that they provide the services for. Our original plan is this would be for a 20-year plan, but we're out of space right now. Just as an example to give you, before I came to this meeting, I had an HR meeting and a few others. We were trying to talk about space. We are doubling and tripling up people in current offices that were designed for one for a variety of reasons, and we were contemplating a new project, potentially applying for a grant that would look at post-conviction DNA analysis. And we're not sure we can apply for the grant because we cannot find space for even one more DNA scientist at this point in time. So we'll have to rethink how we can do some of this going forward. That's why it's critical to build this facility now so that we can make sure that we're meeting those new and emerging needs for law enforcement and for our criminal justice partners across the state. These are just examples and pictures in your packet. Left-hand side, that's a NIBIN room, National Integrated Ballistics Information Network. That's where we enter cartridge casings. We had one machine. We now have four statewide, and you can see it's being shared by many people. That's a gun range, not for actually practicing. That's a gun range for examination of guns coming into our facilities. There should not be boxes in there. We're simply converting spaces that were used for storage and others to house storage in there. And then that's an example of an office designed for one agent that has three people in there right now. I would note that this is just a rendering of what that facility would look like. As noted, that the construction costs are at $48 million for that bonding project. There's been widespread support of law enforcement in southern Minnesota. One thing I'm consistently hearing from them is that they need more training brought to them as opposed to having them travel. This would have a training room at that facility that would accommodate ongoing regular training for our partners so they don't have to travel to the Twin Cities to pay for hotels, fill additional shifts, etc., to make sure we have a regional approach, and we're looking at that. Four of the six statewide victim advocacy coalitions support this project as well, knowing that these forensic examinations are critically important to bringing justice across our state. And so with that, I believe we're happy to answer questions about any of the topics today.
All right, thank you, Superintendent. And I do have a question for Director Weeks, if you want to come down. My question for you is, I was curious to know, you have the amount in here for the victim services that was funded. If you can just remind us what the ask was, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, members. So the request in the governor's supplemental budget is for an additional $10 million for crime victim services. Last year, during our competitive process with the combination of the investment that the legislature made with crime victim services, we had approximately $63 million available. We received over $100 million in requests.
Okay, thank you. Other questions for the committee, for any of the agency staff here? Yep, go ahead, Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious what the thinking is behind shifting the percentage for administering grants from 2% to 10%. That seems like a really big jump, and I'm just curious what the considerations were there. Thank you.
Director Weeks.
Chair members, great question. So last year, there is a statewide standard that was set into statute for competitive grants. Agencies will be able to use up to 10%. So it doesn't mean they are using 10%, it's up to 10%. Legislatively directed grants would be at 5%. And so with the 2% in statute, I can tell just from implementing the YIP program that 2% never covered what it cost to actually do grant administration. And we were receiving dings from the OLA that we were not meeting all of our obligations because we just simply didn't have enough staff. And so knowing that the YIP program is moving over to a new state agency, we want to make sure that they have the ability to ensure that they're going to be meeting all of the requirements. And so also want to lift it up to that state standard.
right. Lead Navadia. Oh, well, let's move on to Grassl and then Lead Navadia. Go ahead, represent Grassl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry for the delay. Question for Superintendent Evans, if I may. Just asking about the massive increase in digital media evidence and analysis, that type of stuff. Can you give us some examples of what that digital media would be?
Superintendent Evans.
Madam Chair and Representative Grassl, thank you for the question. The primary work that group does right now is related to our child sexual abuse material, online exploitation of children. In particular, we've had significant increases in the number of tips that have come in through our ICAC task force affiliate program that we do. However, that being said, it represents, for example, I worked homicide when I just like to say I was doing real work daily instead of the management role that I have now. But when I first started, we rarely seized an electronic device. We have multiple devices on every single investigation we're conducting right now, from our financial crimes unit at the BCA, et cetera. But externally to our partners, it's primarily child sexual abuse material and online exploitation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Superintendent, that the numbers that I got from you earlier were right around from 2016, 1,100 reports to 2023, increased to over 9,100 reports of this kind of materials being coming into the BCA labs to be gone over, and most of those, I would imagine, may be actionable cases.
Superintendent Evans.
Madam Chair, Representative Grassl, those are all tips that come in through the whole committee from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children of potential cases. There are a number of them. Definitely, the increase of actionable cases, to answer your question, has increased significantly over the last 6 to 7 years in particular.
Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Superintendent. I guess just drives what I've been working on for years, Madam Chair, is the importance of making sure that we help these people, help the BCA and all of our agents and deputies and peace officers, police officers, to stop this crime.
Yeah, thank you.
It's there. Yep. We're taking too small of steps, Madam Chair.
I have a question for you, Superintendent Evans, on the report that came out on crime in Minnesota and this particular child sexual abuse cases. Abuse material cases, it seemed like the clearance rate was quite low. If you could please tell us what the clearance rate was for that cases and what clearance rate means, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you for the question. I don't have the clearance rate right in front of me, but I agree with you, it was low when I've looked at this before. I think that there's a number of factors that are going on when it comes to that particular clearance rate. One is because it's often investigated as a proactive crime, meaning that it was a tip that came in, but the investigation itself is somewhat proactive in relation to that tip, that I'm not sure that they're always being cleared adequately on the back end by our law enforcement agencies that do NIBRS-based reporting. I also would note that when it comes to these tips, there is a piece that would be related to, for example, teenagers that may be sharing material that would be considered child sexual abuse material, but it's teenager to teenager, both being underage. We typically do not prosecute those types of cases. We're interested in identifying the individuals that are trafficking and consuming child sexual abuse material. That number, though, as we've been looking into it, I think there's some improvement that needs to be done in terms of the reporting of the clearances by law enforcement. I think it is cleared at a higher number than what you're seeing in that particular number.
Thank you. We'll move on to Lead Novotny.
Chair Moeller, Superintendent Evans, just want to speak in favor of the expansion and the decentralization of these labs and the training facilities. In the same vein that you mentioned that your experts have to go out and testify, you know, for everything that they have to testify, there's 10 or 15 or 20 cases that have to be brought to you that, you know, the road time just for the lab techs or people bringing in evidence could be cut exponentially if we decentralize these facilities. So strongly in favor of it.
All right. Thank you. I don't see any other member comments or questions. Thank you to the commissioner and staff for attending here. Now we have Department of Corrections budget and bonding presentation as well. And Commissioner Schnell is here. So please go ahead and begin your presentation. And as with the last one, we do have that in our packets and it's posted online as well. Welcome back, Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Paul Schnell, again, from the Department of Corrections, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide an overview of the department's budget and bonding request for this session. For a quick overview, there are three parts to the DOC's budget request this year, and I'll speak briefly to each one. First, we have an operating adjustment request to accommodate for an additional, some additional agency costs, including the essential compensation increases for staff. Next, I'll speak to the federal 1115 Medicaid demonstration waiver, a proposal that the DOC is partnering with the Department of Human Services on to allow Medicaid to be billed for services within correctional facilities up to 90 days prior to release. Next, we'll talk about a bill to include some minor language fixes in one section of the Minnesota Rehabilitation Reinvestment Act. And lastly, I'll touch on the profound infrastructure investment needs at the DOC and in the department's bonding request this year. Members, the numerous investments in the DOC last year were an integral part of the governor and lieutenant governor's One Minnesota budget. By investing in rehabilitation, you invested in public safety and the DOC's mission of transforming lives for a safer Minnesota. The DOC is not putting forward a large legislative agenda this year in order to focus our attention on successfully implementing those proposals. This slide is for your reference, as it represents the enormous amount of work that our staff are doing and has done since the legislature has adjourned in 2023. And I'm happy to speak to these in detail at another time or provide members information about any of these efforts upon request. Members, moving on to the DOC's request for additional funding, the governor's supplemental budget proposal includes an operating increase of $7.9 million in fiscal year 25 and 26 and $14.2 million in fiscal years 27 and 28. The need for this additional funding arises out of cost pressures within the department, the most significant of which are staffing costs. The DOC employs approximately 4,300 staff. Last year, labor partners in the state of Minnesota agreed to a historic compensation increases. These contracts included essential increases for corrections staff, positions that were previously not competitive with county and federal positions that were similar and greatly contributed to our staffing crisis the department faced. Last year, before this committee, I testified that stabilizing our workforce was a necessity. We had conversations about staff safety stemming from understaffing, and while corrections work has associated risks, that no matter staffing levels, there is little argument that operating at funded complement is the safest option. The department has used salary savings from open positions to the greatest extent possible, and while we have done all we could, to request only what is absolutely necessary to accommodate increased costs. Cost pressures of compensation increases, workers' compensation, and health care costs needs of the incarcerated have all collectively created a deficiency that requires the operating adjustment. Members, in considering the DOC's operating adjustment, I want to be clear on the impact this funding is having. Over the last few years, we have made enormous efforts to recruit individuals to work at the Department of Corrections as corrections officers. Through those efforts, we have hired an unprecedented number of people to do the work. However, we had retained less than half of them. We've had vacancy rates at some facilities like Stillwater and Oak Park Heights as high as 30% at some points. To address these shortages and ensure staff and facility safety, we were forced to rely on overtime to fulfill security posts. Often, this was forced overtime, affecting the newest staff the most. Being forced to work a double shift when you need to be home to care for your family simply does not work, and that reality was reflected in our retention rates. We simply were not competitive with the county jails or the Federal Bureau of Prisons, as I mentioned. Last summer, the negotiated contracts changed the landscape for us. We can say that today we are more competitive. Today, a career in corrections as an officer begins starting pay at $44 per hour, and will increase to $28.67 per hour effective July 1st of 2024. There are currently 157 officers in training, and we are soon to be at a 97% staffing levels for officers across all facilities. Members, the final portion of the DOC's budget request is included not in this committee's target, but in the Department of Human Services target, and that request is known as the 1115 waiver. I want to bring it to this committee's attention because it has significant impact on the work of the Department of Corrections and also is important to the sheriffs across our state, and I'll explain in just a moment. Members, as you're likely aware, when an individual becomes incarcerated, they lose health coverage, and instead their health coverage becomes the sole responsibility of the corrections institution. The DOC has a constitutional responsibility to provide direct care to those within our custody. With the exception of some inpatient hospital care, federal law precludes Medicaid from covering health care expenses of incarcerated individuals. Despite 90 to 95% of the DOC's population being Medicaid eligible. Incarcerated individuals shifting between health systems, health care, often results in a disconnect from treatment, which leads to worsening of their overall health. For people with mental health conditions and substance use disorders, this inconsistent health care coverage can have grave impacts. Recent data confirms that drug overdose is now a leading cause of death among formerly incarcerated individuals. Those who are recently released from prisons and jails are up to 40 times more likely to die of an opioid overdose than the general population. This proposal aims to curb these numbers by facilitating a smoother transition from physical and mental health care services inside jails and prisons to outside. In April of 2023, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, announced a new Section 1115 demonstration that allows states to partially waive the inmate exclusion and provide Medicaid coverage shortly before reentry into the community. Through this program, when state savings are realized after Medicaid reimbursements, those savings must be reinvested into expanding program and treatment options. The Department of Human Services has been studying and developing a proposal to include Minnesota in this waiver, and DHS is requesting legislative approval and funding to apply through CMS for the program and support Medicaid-eligible populations in jails and prisons 90 days prior to release. In coordination with DHS, in order to implement the program at three DOC facilities, the DOC will require staff and some a new DOC billing system. Currently, the DOC does not bill insurance or Medicaid for any health services, so this endeavor is a new line of work and processes for the department. The governor's supplemental budget request in the DHS target includes $1.7 million in FY24-25 and $4.3 million in FY26-27 for corrections. During the initial phase of the process, the state would establish the system infrastructure and staffing the program at three DOC facilities, four county jails, two local juvenile detention facilities, and one local county jail that incarcerates a significant number of Native Americans. We and our county sheriff partners are excited to have this transformational interagency opportunity and its potential to better serve the needs of the incarcerated individuals reentering our communities across the state from our county jails and from state prisons. Members, as you are aware, one of the most substantial initiatives we are working to implement is the Minnesota Reinvestment and Rehabilitation and Reinvestment Act, or MRRA. For a brief recap, MRRA is an earned early release program. It shifts the focus from the state's approach to corrections from how much time people spend in prison to how they spend that time, and evidence-based interventions targeting reduction of risk for reoffending and reduce reoffending means less crime. As part of implementation, the DOC requests two technical corrections to the statute to be included in the supplemental budget bill. The first of those corrections clarifies that incentives apply to supervised release and conditional release, ensuring that earned compliance credits and supervision abatement status also extend to both supervised and conditional release makes sense and streamlines the administration of this component of MRA. Secondly, the language updates the reinvestment portion of the bill. While nothing changes with where the savings are reinvested, as MRA was being debated last year, the legislature also amended the statute governing how the state funds community supervision and probation. This change simply aligns reinvestment with the supervision delivery systems. I also want to note that you will see language in the budget bill that will formally separate the newly created Clemency Review Commission from the DOC, including shifting funding appropriated to the commissioner of the DOC to the entity that was created last year. Members, moving on to another critically important issue.
Commissioner, if I could just stop you for just a second. We only have 10 minutes left, and I know members have questions for you, too. And we know your needs for infrastructure are immense and great. And we'll address, like I said earlier in the interim, we'll talk in detail about some of those needs. So for the rest of your presentation, if you just focus in on the ones that are covered in the bonding request, that would be great.
Madam Chair, thank you. I would just say that the bonding side, we have there really are two fundamental requests. That is asset preservation, which is significant across the system. The DOC has more than $723 million in backlog infrastructure needs that exist. Many members have seen those facilities. And the second is a request for a standalone project at the Rust City facility, which today does not have the ability to meet the programming needs of the people at that facility. Despite the fact that this facility was built as a single bunked facility, it is today double bunked and does not have a space to meet even the most basic programming needs for the men that are housed there. This would change that and allow for the department to be able to provide those, meet those programming needs. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I'm going to circle back to Representative Witte for the question you had on Representative Finke's bill. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Chair or Commissioner Schnell. My question is on the visitation. Two parts. Have you had a lot of complaints about the lack of people having visitation rights? And then from a staff perspective, because we've heard overtime and stuff like that, how much would the cost be, the additional to have that space for them? Thank you.
Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, Representative Witte, we certainly visiting has been profoundly impacted by the staffing shortages. We do anticipate that is changing now, that our staffing levels are finally reaching the levels that they should be. So our staffing of visiting, we should be able to meet those needs in a much better way. However, I want to be clear that the staffing levels are the visiting hours are nowhere near what are being proposed in the bill that Representative Finke brought forward. The cost of staffing that will be significant. I don't know what the final number is. That is being finalized, and as was mentioned, the Legislative Budget Office is looking for some additional information, but it will be significant to staff what is really 12 to 14 hours a day. Is what that would look like.
All right, Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Schnell, I have a question here for you. Looking back at the 2020 to 2022 DOC strategic priority plan, as well as the 2023 plan, I see something under agency reorganization that cites a goal of achieving zero warehousing. Can you provide me some clarification as to what that means?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Ingen, the goal really is to try to reduce the inactivity of the people that are in prison, and that means to maximize programming. obviously, when you have COVID, COVID really impacted our ability to operate programming. We fundamentally had to warehouse people because we had to keep people safe. We could, you know, for the sake of our staff, we had high levels of staff illness that were occurring during COVID, very low levels of staffing in many cases, depending upon outbreaks that were occurring in the prison. So, but our goal was to try and maximize programming. We know that when we can maximize programming and reduce idleness, that makes the prisons that much more safe. And in order to do that, nothing happens in a prison without security staff, nothing. And so that's why stabilizing our workforce, our security workforce, had to be our number one priority. And trust me, being at 97% is a huge, huge windfall for us to be able to hit that objective of not warehousing and having people access programming.
Chair Beckerman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to note for the record, I know we went through it pretty quickly and I understand why, but just wanted to note that the conditions in some of our facilities, that it is both the health and safety of the incarcerated folks, but also a very real health impact on employees. So I just kind of wanted to note that those employees are also really important as we talk about, you know, looking at the pictures of mold and other unsafe conditions, that it's also maybe related to some of the staffing issues, you know, to have folks not necessarily working in safe environments. So appreciate that that's on the list.
Yep. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Chair Beckerman, I appreciate that. I think it is notable that these are it's tough work to start with. The environments are tough to work in. As you point out, I think it, you know, the environments are, the physical environments are also very, very challenging. And I will just say that some of the research that has been done about the stress on people who work inside correctional facilities and what that does on their health has been profound, and specifically on staff in Minnesota correctional facilities. We were participated in a national study. And so we do know that it does have a profound and significant impact. So we need to be concerned about the health and well-being of our staff, and we appreciate the investments that this committee made last year toward helping us focus on their wellness and as well as the environment in this bonding effort.
All right, Lee Novotny.
Chair Moeller, Commissioner Snell, going back to the bill, there's quite a few restrictions that would be put on your specific overseeing and directing of security measures in the jail. Do you have any feelings or comments on the specifics of the visitation under sub 3 from 2.21 through 3.3?
Commissioner Snell.
Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, I think there is some place where I think we need to have some conversations about what that all looks like, and how that's going to work. There is room. We have some policy work that is being done on visiting right now. Our policy chair and our policy committee is doing some review of the existing policy and really looking at some of the elements of our policy, and there will be some changes and relaxing of our policy. It probably will not be as far as the policy that's being proposed in this legislation. But I think certainly there are some places where we would have some concerns and places where we think there would need to be some conversation. So I would agree that we need to have some conversation about what that should look like, especially when you apply it as broadly as it is.
Right. And just a reminder again, we laid that bill over and we're still awaiting a fiscal note. Lee Novotny.
Chair Moeller, Commissioner Snell, how many of your facilities have contact visitation right now?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Lee Novotny, all of them have contact visiting.
Lee Novotny.
Thank you. Chair Snell, or Commissioner Snell, would you agree that increasing these visits would increase the opportunity for introduction of contraband, especially with as undetectable as fentanyl would be, to be able to be passed, and greatly increasing these contact visits. Would you agree that something as simple as an underwire from a bra being passed to a prisoner could create a safety concern?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Lee Devotny, there's no doubt that any time, whether that's a visitor or staff or whatever, that stuff can happen. And I think one of the key questions, as was talked about, is, you know, the ability to exercise and use technology. The body scanners are, I think, one of the tools that today is a game changer for maintaining and better managing the safety of our facilities and visiting.
Anything to the presentation? We are at noon. Lead Novotny.
We'll hit it again. Thank you, Chair.
All right. That is it for member discussion. Thank you, Commissioner, and to your staff for being here as well. And that is it for our agenda. This meeting is adjourned.